Okay, thanks, Mike. And thanks, Mike and Marcus, and the other organizers, for inviting me. Thank you guys for being here. And thank the other speakers, because I've been learning a lot. So background to this, a lot of my work has been trying to understand what the empirical success of quantum theory is telling us about the world we live in. And one of the questions you can ask is, should we think of quantum states as reflecting features of physical reality or not? And one of the ways that they might not, we've already heard about from a couple speakers, they might be merely subjective degrees of belief. And I have no idea why this just clicked off.
It could be your screensaver.
It could be, yes, thank you.
Could be the beamer and it's broken.
Yep. You know what? I'm just going to plug in because I think... Yeah, I'm just going to plug in because I think I've got it set to turn itself off when on battery and not to do it when it's plugged in. So bear with me a moment. Okay, very good. All right, I'm here. I got it.
Please just double check that there is power going to the computer. The outlet right where you are may not be working.
Okay.
You want to go one row over.
All right.
I
used it. Let me see. It says it's getting power. Thank you. We're plugged in. All right. So. All right. Okay. Starting again. So one of the questions is whether we should think of quantum states as reflecting something in physical reality or not. And that's what I'm going to be talking about today. Well, if you've heard some of the discussions already, you can probably guess what I think. And in fact, the title kind of gives it away, because there's something in journalism called Betteridge's Law of Headlines, which says that any headline that ends in a question mark can be answered by the word no. And actually, if you look at newspaper headlines, there are remarkably few exceptions to this. So I'm going to argue, well, not something quite as strong as they cannot, because obviously you can, and there are people who do. And I'm not going to claim that those people are thereby inconsistent or contradicting themselves. What I want to do today is explain to you the reasons why I think we have good reasons to think that quantum states do reflect something in reality. So the question I want to ask is, what conclusion do we come to if we just simply examine the evidence we have in favor of us and ask what it's telling us about the world? So I'm not going to try to argue that a cubist is necessarily self-contradictory. So I'm going to tell you the reasons why, and the conclusion is going to be, I think that we actually do have good reasons for thinking that. As good reasons as we do for an awful lot of things in science. And part of my motivation of doing this is that, if I were to convince everyone in the room, that would be great. But I think that that's very, very unlikely, because there's some very smart people in the room who have been thinking about this for an awful long time and have come to a opposite conclusion. So part of my motivation is doing that is to help to understand those reasons a little bit better. So one of the things I'd like to hear in the discussion period, for those who don't follow it to the conclusion, exactly where did you get off the train? Okay. Now, this is the idea that quantum states don't represent anything in physical reality is not a new idea. And in particular, and I think this has been already mentioned, Einstein said in several places that he thought that in a future theory, quantum states are going to bear a relation to a deeper underlying theory, pretty much the same relation that probability distributions and statistical mechanics play relation have to the more detailed, classical description. And so one of the motivations, and there's different people have different motivations, but one of the motivations for this kind of for denying that quantum states reflect anything in physical reality is something like this. And I just want to acknowledge that there are good reasons to think this is a well-motivated research program. And some of the people in this room have provided some of the reasons. There are certain features in common between quantum states and classical probability distributions. You can recover some fragments of quantum mechanics that can be covered by classical theory with restrictions on preparation and access to information. In particular, this is something that's been emphasized by Rob Speckens on more than one occasion. And sort of as a concomitant on that, there are a host of phenomena that you might have thought of as peculiarly quantum that are being covered in these series. The whole, Rob, in one of his recent papers, the one that in the book that he and Giulio co-edited, it has a list of these things. All right, so I do think that these sorts of things do motivate the search, a research program of trying to find a theory like that. So if they can, as motivated research, they serve their purpose well. However, and we can talk about this if you disagree, it doesn't seem to me that they count as strong evidence in favor of a conclusion, this is the way the world is like, that the quantum states are not part of the furniture of the world. And the difference matters. Because if there's evidence that ordinary scientific patterns of reasoning would lead to the conclusion that quantum states are part of physical reality, then if we had strong evidence that they're not, we could, if the evidence was strong enough, be reasonable to then question those patterns of reasoning. In particular, what I'm going to try to do is give an argument for the reality of quantum states based on the sorts of assumptions that are routinely taken for granted in science. They're not handed down to us on tablets of stone. If we had good reason to think that the conclusion that follows from those assumptions is false, it might become reasonable to reject those assumptions. But it doesn't seem to me that we are in a situation like that. Yes.
So I'm not sure I copied this down right, but I thought the question was, does the quantum state reflect something real? But now you're saying, is it real? Is there any, do you
I didn't
as equivalent? Because
I meant them as pretty much equivalent. Yeah, I think the reason I said reflect is one of the ways it could be real is if it's not fundamental, but whatever is fundamental, the fundamental state of the world determines what the quantum state is, on a sort of higher level thing. Yeah. Or I think what I meant was what to say is, do quantum state descriptions reflect features of reality? So when we ascribe a quantum state to something, is that representing something in reality? I think that's what I meant to say.
Okay. So, I mean, I ask because I would agree with the first, with what you just said, with the stronger statement.
Well, let's talk later about the difference between those statements, because I didn't actually intend them to be. What I do like is when we ascribe a quantum state to something, it represents something in physical reality. That's what I want to claim. Okay.
Wayne, when you talk about these assumptions, do you mean things like locality, non-contextuality, things like that? Or do you
No, they'll become clear. Be the assumptions I'm actually making.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so where I'm headed is I want to present an argument that's based on the PBR theorem from 2012, but a variant of it that starts with it from a different assumption. And basically, the assumptions I'm going to be talking about, the basic framework of the ontological models, plus this extra assumption that I'm going to use to replace the PBR preparation independent postulate, which I'll get to. So that's the assumptions that I mean. Okay. But yeah, they're not locality assumptions, because that would be a problem. Because if we take, I think we have good reason to believe that the world is in some sense non-local. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to present my own variant of the PBR theorem. Before that, I'm going to fairly briefly review the PBR theorem. It'll be familiar to some people in the room, and not to others. But the beauty of the theorem is it's really short and simple. Before that, I want to. What I'm going to start out doing is just start with considerations of some common patterns of reasoning as motivation for the framework in which the theorem is cast. And that framework is the ontological models framework, which was presented by Rob and Harrigan a number of years ago. But I think what they did is they codified the sort of reasoning that's implicit in a lot of the way that people think about this. But the virtue of making it explicit is, then you get to put it to work. And I think that likely that PBR, might not have answered the question if it hadn't been phrased in a particular way by Harrigan and Speckens. So, all right. So, stepping back, I want to talk about a very ordinary, mundane kind of situation that happens both in everyday life and is also analyzed in information theory contexts, be it classical or quantum. So Alice has a message she wants to send to Bob. And actually, I was thinking about this morning, I phrased this in terms of two different agents. But it could actually be you sending a message to your future self. So, for example, this morning, as I was listening to Rüdiger's talk, I was taking notes on my laptop because I wanted to remember some of the things that he said. And what I'm going to do tomorrow is take a look at those. And I'm going to take what I see when I look at my laptop as informative of what it was that I typed this morning. All right. So the basic schema, you've got some kind of physical system that's going to be the medium of communication. It may be something that Alice sends something along a telegraph wire to Bob, or it could just be me taking my laptop to my hotel room. Choice of operations that you can perform on the system. So when I'm typing up my laptop, I have a choice of which keys to press. And Bob has some kind of readout device. It could be the screen on the laptop. And it performs some kind of experiment on the system where it produces a perceptible readout. And the point of all this, if Alice and Bob are engaged in this, shared presupposition is that the readout that Bob gets is informative about the choice of preparations that Alice made. Okay. And that, I think, is a sort of minimal schema that presupposed in any discussion of information theory, and also in everyday life in a numerous context. Okay, now I'm going to add to something with that. because you know, people who actually want to implement protocols or people who want to design laptops, you know, what they want to do is come up with some statistical system that is amenable to being used as a medium in that sense. And typically, they'll have some kind of physical theory about the system. It might even be, it might be a very schematic engineering kind of level thing. And the idea behind denying these things, the presupposition there, I think, is that Alice's operation has some effect on the state of the system, which Bob learns about. So for example, I actually have very little idea of how this laptop works. But I do believe that when I press certain keys on Wednesday morning, somehow or another, it has an effect on the internal state of the system. And then when I turn it on the next day and pull up that file, I'm finding out about the internal state of my laptop, which I had an effect on yesterday. Okay. Now, there's a very special case, which my laptop actually closely approximates, is that Bob sees a little readout. He becomes certain of what Alice's choice was. So if I look at my laptop tomorrow and I see a certain string of characters, my credence goes in damn near one that that's the string of characters I typed yesterday. Maybe not exactly one, but damn near one. So let's consider the ideal case in which it actually goes to one. Well, might ask why. You know, why does Bob, upon seeing a readout, a certain readout, become certain about what Alice's choice of preparation was? I think it's natural, in fact, hard to escape the conclusion that even if Bob's knowledge of the state of the system is kind of vague, or knowledge of the physics is kind of vague, that he thinks that the readout he saw could only have been produced by one of Alice's choices. It's not absolutely necessary. It could be that what Alice did had no effect on the mediating system at all, but somehow or another, God intervenes and makes sure there's an outcome that reflects what she did. But I think the natural presupposition that is that, you know, if Bob or if I tomorrow look and see a certain string of characters and become certain that that's what was typed yesterday, it's because I think that I wouldn't be seeing those characters if that wasn't what was typed. Everyone got the idea? Okay. That's a special case. In the more general case, Bob won't be certain. There'll be some error. There'll be some kind of noise in the channel, something like that. But nonetheless, when Bob sees his readout, that shifts his credences. He takes it as informative about which operation was chosen by Alice. That's sort of a minimal requirement for this to count as information transfer at all. If what he sees is completely irrelevant to his degrees of belief, I'm going to use the word credence for subjective degree of belief. Philosophers tend to use that. So, what Bob sees is totally irrelevant to his degrees of belief about which operation was chosen by Alice, then there'd be kind of no point to the whole exercise. Okay. So what we have here is, we've got some kind of physical system. Yeah.
When you wrote that, you talked about the state of the system.
Yeah.
Is there any assumption that that's localized in time?
Say that again.
Do you attach the state to a particular moment of time?
Yes. Should I not?
I don't think so. But
okay. Yeah. I do.
You do.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah, because I'm talking about changing. You know, Alice changing the state. So it was. You know, it might be something different after she does her preparation than it was before. So it's time indexed.
But I mean, does the reality at that time, what if that has meaning, does that fully determine the state? That's the question.
So you're imagining a situation where so we got reality at this time, but the state might somehow be like...
It might refer to the past.
Refer to the past. I'm assuming that that's... any influence of the past on the future is mediated by the current state. Yeah, I am assuming that. Okay, all right. I could probably drop... Let me know if it matters.
Okay.
I could probably drop that as far as I can tell. But anyways, let's talk later about that. Okay. Okay. Well, here what we have is Alice has a choice of preparations. We have some kind of physical state of the system. Bob might have some choice of things he can do to get a readout, but there should be some kind of influence of the physical state of the system on the readout. And because we don't want to assume that any of this is deterministic, we don't want to assume that what Alice does uniquely determines the outcome of Bob's experiments, so we're going to have to bring probabilities into this. And if I say what I just said and say it a little more formally, we get pretty much the ontological models framework of Kerrigan and Speckitz. So we assume that on a physical system, there's going to be some kind of state space, and I'm not presupposing anything about the structure of it, so it could be a classical phase space, it could be a Hilbert space, it could be Hilbert space plus hidden variables, it could be something belonging to some physical theory that I've never thought of yet. And because we're going to want probabilities over the state space, we're going to have to turn it into a measurable space, so there's some set of subsets of the state space, which are going to be the measurable sets, the ones we're going to assign probabilities to. So standard move-in probability theory. Right. And what we're going to do is associate with preparations some probability distribution on that state space. And then for an experiment, and I'm only considering experiments with a finite set of outcomes, but you can imagine a Cantor input, I suppose. You know, there's going to be a set of functions, one for each possible outcome, and that given on state, ontic state omega, this is going to be the probability that I'm going to get outcome A in that state. Rüdiger wanted to get rid of lambda, so I changed them all to omegas. okay. Because these are probabilities, and this is supposed to be an exhaustive set of possible outcomes, they have to add up to one. And then, as John Heder, the law of total probability says that, okay, if I do preparation, and we have a probability distribution on that, which gives probabilities to various sets of the probability distribution over the ontic state space. And I have these, then the probability of an outcome K is just going to be expectation value of this function there with respect to that probability distribution. So that's what these angle brackets mean. Yeah. Expectation value of a random variable. Okay. Now it seems to me, there's some discussion earlier about the meaning of probability. Should probabilities be thought of as subjective? Are there objective chances? It seems to me that everything I'm about to say is pretty much orthogonal to those discussions, as long as you think you can ascribe probabilities to single events, and not only the infinite sequences of events. And we could talk about frequentism. I don't think that it works for basically the sorts of reasons that Rüdiger said. So in particular, I could take this probability distribution, to be Bob's degrees of belief. How likely do you regard certain physical states given this preparation? Then I also ask Bob is, he could have conditional credences. If the physical state is omega, what's the probability of getting this outcome? So for example, I might have degrees of belief about whether it's going to rain or snow tomorrow. I might have degrees of belief about the temperature outside. And I can form conditional degrees of belief conditional on it being below zero, what's your degree of belief that it's going to snow, et cetera. So you could take these as conditional credences, conditional on the ontic state being omega, what's the probability of this outcome? The reason I don't think it matters whether those are regarded as subjective degrees of belief or something physical, something out there in reality, is I'm going to get the conclusion I want either way. If you'd like, take all the probabilities that we're going to talk about as some agent's subjective degrees of belief. And though provided that agent's subjective degrees of belief satisfy another condition that I'm going to introduce, then the conclusion is there's going to be that agent should think that distinctions between quantum states reflect are distinctions in reality.
Right. I don't quite get that. I mean, if they're determined by omega,
I'm not presuming it's determined by omega. That would be the case where all of these are zero or one.
Probabilities, I meant.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
So what I'm saying is these vary with omega. They could, at least. So your subjective degree of belief about the outcome of an experiment could your subjective degree of belief about the outcome of an experiment conditional on the supposition that the physical state is omega could vary with omega. Right. That's all I'm saying.
But that's a principle kind of construction.
Doesn't need to be because principle only comes in if there are objective chances around. I'm not even presuming that there are objective chances at all. If you take this to be a subjective probability distribution and those to be subjective conditional credences. Okay. All right. I want to talk about this notion of preparation. It's a familiar notion, but if you think about it, it's kind of an odd notion. Because on the previous slide, what I said was, I'm an association, so with a preparation, a probability distribution over the ontic state space. And I can specify that probability distribution without saying anything at all, except that what that preparation was. So as Kraft says, if it's a laboratory experiment, I don't care whether it's raining or not raining outside. All I care about is a switch on the apparatus. In particular, if I'm doing that, then I'm pretty much ignoring the previous state of the system. And so for something to count as a not any operation is going to count as a preparation in the sense that we want it to. Because every operation is going to have this, is going to give you a probability distribution on which the past of the system is irrelevant. So preparation is a special sort of operation that screens off the past and pretty much everything else except what you regard as relevant to the preparation. It's not necessary, as a matter of logical necessity, that such things are possible. But it is deeply embedded in the practice of experimental science, in the notion of a controlled experiment, that if you try hard enough, you can at least make a good approximation of this. We also tend to think that, as Koslov said, you know, if we do a certain preparation in the lab, then it doesn't matter whether it's raining or not raining in Tanzania, even though there might be events in the common past that might potentially create correlations between these things. And so for something to count as a local proper preparation, the idea is it screens off correlations with other things. So the assumption I'm going to make is that if you try hard enough, you can come up with operations that at least closely approximate those conditions. Mark.
It's a somehow weak point, right? I mean, we know from Bell's theorem that locality in the ontological model may be in conflict with operational locality on the level of quantum states. So this might already give us reason to doubt whether the seemingly innocent assumption is actually something that...
Yeah, so here's the thing. Yeah, so if the possibility of local preparation depended on some kind of locality assumption, we'd be in trouble. Because I think that violations of Bell inequalities do give us reason to believe that there is actual non-locality in nature. So the assumption isn't a locality assumption. The assumption is that whatever entanglement your system might have with other things at a distance, there is some operation you can do which we're going to count as a local preparation and is going to at least approximately screen off that entanglement and make it irrelevant to future events. That's the assumption. So yes, it's not a locality assumption, it's not an assumption that every operation you can do will have this feature, because I think we have good reason to think that's false. Yeah. So preparation is a very special kind of operation. Rob, what were you say?
Yeah, I just want to get some clarity on what it means to screen off the past of the system. So I have a counterexample in mind.
Yeah.
And I'm giving the counterexample, you tell me how I'm understanding you correctly. But if I had a preparation that proceeded, for example, by, say it's a four-level system.
Yeah.
And you first do a measurement of some orthonormal basis.
Right.
And then you follow it up by a measurement that just coarse grains it into two rank two subspaces.
Okay.
If I don't keep track of the outcome of the first measurement, and I say the preparation is just registering the outcome of that second measurement, I'm preparing a mixed state onto one of those two subspaces. Now, it's not true that the outcome of that second measurement screens off the final ontic state from the outcome of the first measurement, right? Because it's not as if I could have learned everything about the outcome of the first from learning the outcome of the second. So it fails to have that notion of screening off.
Right.
And
yeah.
It's sort of unclear on what notion of screening off a general preparation could.
Yeah. So. I'm not. So in principle, you could keep track of what the outcome of the first experiment was, right? Yeah. And then this coarse graining operation. What's it do?
It's a coarse grain measurement. It does a measurement of, say, you know, is it in the first two dimensional subspace,
right.
The second two dimensional. So it's
and since that commutes with the first one, it doesn't disturb the state of the first one.
Yeah,
I wouldn't count that as a preparation.
Sorry,
I wouldn't count that as a preparation.
I would not
because that second one, you know, knowing which of these subspaces in it. That doesn't summarize everything you think is relevant to future experiment. I mean, I think Chasov said it nicely yesterday, when we ascribe pure quantum state to things, we think that actually sums up everything that's relevant to the future. Right.
So here you're referring to preparations of pure states, not mixed states, then, because for any preparation of a mixed state, you'd presumably agree that there's more to be known.
Depends on how it's done.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If in principle you could keep track of what pure state it is in that mixture, then yeah, I think that wouldn't satisfy these kind of conditions.
But to some extent, you've sort of built this in then by definition. You're saying by a preparation, I mean something that
yes.
only outputs all the information about the system that's relevant to the future, and therefore, by definition, it screens off everything from the past.
That's exactly what I'm saying. That's what I mean by a preparation. So I think it's a sort of implicit the idea that there's a unique probability distribution that you associate with a preparation. Because on the one that you have, someone who doesn't know the state might ascribe, someone who doesn't know the result of that first measurement might ascribe certain probabilities to outcomes of future experiments. But someone who does might ascribe different ones. So in that case, there's not a unique probability distribution we associate with the operation.
Like an intersubjectively agreed one, unique, is that what you mean? Each agent has a unique one, but you want some other notion.
Because if I say, I am just saying what I'm going to count as a preparation, but I think it's, and what I'm doing is just implicit in what, in what I wrote here, because we're associating a probability distribution with the preparation, and we're not also indexing it by agent. So yeah, I'm not saying it's not p psi alpha, where alpha is an agent. Now, having said that. I could very well now say, okay, if you want, index by the agent and let everything I say be probability distributions for that agent. And then if that agent is associating a probability distribution with a preparation, and I do assume that a preparation is a, there are equivalence classes of, preparation is a type of operation that you can do. So I can take multiple systems and apply what counts as the same preparation. And so if my agent, given what that agent counts as repeats of the same preparation, if that agent associates the same probability distribution over state space with each of them, then the preparation does, in fact, summarize everything that agent regards as relevant to the future. Yeah.
So is it okay to understand this related to Pearl's notion of intervention, where you cut off everything that's not, so by intervening and setting all the parents, you cut off all the dependencies of the past.
Yeah, I think that the assumption that we can do this sort of thing is, say, embedded in Pearl's account of causality. Yeah. Yeah.
Later, it's about 20 minutes left.
Yeah, this is going a lot slower than I hoped, and I want to actually get to the punchline. Yeah. Okay, all right. Okay, so. So it might be that nothing I can do really makes the past irrelevant. But when you're talking about a controlled experiment, we assume that, okay, if the experimenter says we prepared these systems in such ways that these ways, then they don't have to mention anything else. So it might become reasonable to reject this assumption that the operations of this sort are possible. But to quote someone, if I consider the physical phenomena with which I'm equated, especially those which are so successfully comprehended by means of quantum mechanics, and nevertheless, I know where to find a fact which makes it appear to me probable that one has to give up this assumption. And that, some of you will recognize, is from Einstein's 1948 Dialectica article, Quantum Mechanics and Reality, and he is, they're talking about the assumptions of separability and locality. I think he was quite reasonable. And I think he's actually right that in 1948, no one had ever given him any reason to think that we should give up those assumptions. We're in a different situation now. The successful application of quantum mechanics basically assumes that I can prepare a state and I can get as close to a pure state as I want to. And given that that is presupposed in the actual application of quantum mechanics, there's no way the success of quantum mechanics could possibly give us reason to think it's false. Okay. All right. Quickly. Terminology. I'm mostly following the terminology in Matt Leifer's review paper of Scientology theories, which is itself based on the terminology in Speckens and Harrigan. Preparation is distinguishable, if there's an experiment such that no matter what outcome I get, that can only have come from one experiment. It's got non-zero probability anyway. So that would be one case where that would be a case where there's a choice of operations, choice of preparations, and I can do experiment and become certain about which one it was. Say a pair of preparations is ontologically distinct if there's no overlap in the corresponding probability distributions, if there's no set to which both of them ascribe non-zero probability. Fair, should be intuitively clear, and it's actually a nice little theorem that if you have a distinguished set of preparations, there's no overlap in the probability distributions of any pair of them. Matt Leifer's terminology, a set of preparations is anti-distinguishable if there's an experiment E such of the each of the outcome. Each outcome rules out one of those preparations. Okay. And if you have an anti-distinguishable set, then if you look at the probability distributions corresponding to all the preparations of the set, there's no there's no joint overlap. There's no set assigned positive probability to all by all of them. Okay. What I said earlier is that if Bob becomes certain upon looking at his readout that Alice's of what Operation Alice did, then it's naturally ascribed to Bob belief that there is some set of states that only that operation could produce, and none of the others. And given the framework, that becomes a theorem. What I mean is distinguishable states are ontologically distinct. Distinguishable states are ontologically distinct. And quantum mechanics, non-orthogonal states are not distinguishable. And the question is, are they are ontologically distinct? Distinct pure states are always ontologically distinct, then they represent something in physical reality. The distinction between the states reflects a distinction in physical reality. So terminology, ontological models of quantum mechanics or some fragment of it, if psiontic, if and only if any pair of preparations can correspond to distinct pure states is ontologically distinct. Okay. Very briefly, one of the things that might have motivated some people is the idea that quantum states are like classical probability distributions. And if they, in the classical probability distribution, any any indistinguishability of preparations is due to overlap of the corresponding probability distributions. And you might ask if I could achieve that for quantum mechanics. And the answer is, there's a nice theorem which I won't go into that no, that can't be done. No extra assumptions except the basic framework that I've already mentioned. Okay. About 10 minutes left?
We'll be starting 5 minutes late, so we've got 15.
Okay, all right. Okay, PBR argument. Briefly, imagine you got a pair of systems, and you've got a choice of quantum states that you could prepare each one of them in, and such that the inner product is less than one over square root of two, less than or equal. Then it can be shown, and for reasons of time, I won't go into the exact the proof of that. That if I consider the four possibilities consisting of subjecting each of these systems to one of these preparations, those four possibilities form an anti-distinguishable set, as long as that's satisfied. It follows from that, from what we just said, the corresponding set of probabilities, these distributions don't have any have zero joint support. Now, what PBR then do is impose what's been called the preparation independence postulate, which is really a conjunction of two things. And the postulate is meant only to apply to these sorts of preparations, a pair of local preparations that we would count in quantum mechanics as preparing a quantum a product state. And the claim is that for that limited set of preparations, we can represent the ontic state of the pair as simply consisting of ordered pair of ontic state of one and ontic state of the other one. So that's that would be true in quantum mechanics. The claim is not that that's true all across the board, because we know there are entangled states that go outside the set of product states. So that's the Cartesian product assumption, using Matt Weaver's terminology. And then the no correlations assumption is that for those kinds of preparations, the probability distribution just factorizes into a product of probability distributions on the individual state space. And from that, plus the anti-distinguishability, it follows that the states are on the individual systems are ontologically distinct. And the argument is fairly simple. Suppose they're not. Suppose there's some overlap between psi and phi for A, and that means there's some subset of A's state space that's assigned a non-zero probability by both of those preparations. And suppose they're not ontologically distinct for B, there's some subset of B's state space that's assigned non-zero probability by both of those. And then given that there's some subspace, some set of the joint state space that's assigned non-zero probability by all four preparations, which is incompatible with the indistinguishability of it. Okay. So that's a PBR argument. Now, there's two attitudes that you might take towards this and other related theorems.
What was the omega AB? That's some subset of the full state space? That's presumed to exist, or I didn't?
So it's assumed that we can talk about state spaces of the subsystems.
Right.
And for the sub within the subset of states that could arise for the joint system, we can represent from a pair product preparation, that we can represent those states as just being in the Cartesian product of the individual subsystem state spaces. That's the assumption. Good. Two kinds of attitudes you can take. One is that these are telling us about a fictional world in which quantum mechanics is exactly right. Because this is set within quantum mechanics, not even quantum field theory. Or we could take them as telling something about our world in which quantum mechanics is a low energy proper approximation to quantum field theory, which is presumably a low energy approximation to something else that includes quantum gravity. I want to know about our world. And if that's right, the assumptions we should hold in successor theories to quantum mechanics, including quantum QFT, and also are things that we could reasonably expect to hold in whatever the successor is to that. And they should also be robust under relaxations of idealizations. So this anti-distinguishability we know holds, you know, we can test in the lab that it holds with a high degree of approximation, but laboratory experiments aren't going to tell us that it holds exactly. Okay. Well, I have a worry about this Cartesian product assumption, because if I have two. I have two space-like separated bounded regions. I shouldn't assume that I can prepare product states of those, each of those in its own pure state. I shouldn't assume that I can totally I can do something that completely gets rid of entanglement between those regions. So what I want is a substitute for the preparation independence postulate that does not make use of that Cartesian product assumption. I mean, the way I think about it is, okay, maybe we can get arbitrarily close to product states, but then, you know, the product states are sort of, you know, on the boundary of our physical state space and not necessarily actually in it, or the actually preparable state space. Okay, so and ideally I'd like some assumption that doesn't make any presupposition about the structure of the state space or its relation to the subsystem state spaces. All right.
Question.
Yeah.
So I'm a little confused about why for a given system, why would the structure of the state space itself be in any way dependent on what kinds of preparations over the state space you can do? You seem to be saying if you can do product state preparations, then you shouldn't assign a different ontic state space, but presumably the system defines the ontic state space, not what set of preparations you have access to.
Oh, okay. I didn't mean preparations I have access to. I mean preparations that are physically possible. So if there's a proper subset of the state space that consists of the physically possible preparable states, that includes all the states that are ever going to occur in nature, then that's the subset I'm interested in.
My impression of the PPR statement was that the ontic state space could be written as could be decomposed into a subset of the ontic states here and a subset there, and on this subset,
Right.
It factorizes a Cartesian product.
Right.
And then the claim is that entangled quantum states can have support on the whole.
Right. Right.
But product quantum states only have support in this region.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I was going to say, when you wrote capital omega AB, that's really a subset of the ontic state space.
Right. It's accessible via, it's explored by products. Right, yeah, that is.
The whole ontic state space.
Right,
the whole ontic state space, the two things would be a bigger thing.
So it's never separable.
Right, it's not separable.
Right.
It's only separable on this subset.
And I don't want to even assume that. There's even a subset in which it's separable. Okay, so I want something that's going to do at least some of the same work as the PIP that doesn't make that presupposition. And here's what I came up with. I know I'm running out of time, but so imagine you've got a pair of systems, AB, and there's a choice of local preparations on each. And suppose you're told that Alice and Bob have independently chose which preparation to do, so with these probabilities, so some set PI probabilities for Alice, some set QI probabilities for B, but they choose them independently. So your epistemic state is going to be the corresponding mixture of those preparations, and so they do that. And then somehow or another, Laplace's demon comes along and says, I'm going to tell you the ontic state of the system, joint system. And if you don't think that's possible, imagine conditional credences conditional on the ontic state of the system. Right. So, because I'm really talking about those conditional credences, the credences conditional on the ontic state being this. Right. So those conditional credences. The ontic state presumably is going to be informative about the preparations. So your conditional, so on the basis of this, so this will give your priors about the preparations. Then conditional on the ontic state, you've got some conditional credences, which the ontic state can be informative about those. And so I'm talking about those. And then question is, given though conditional on the ontic state being omega. So this sort of conditional credence, probability of psi 1, psi 2, given omega, conditional of to the pair of preparations. Suppose now I tell you what the preparation on B was. Does that change your credence about the preparation on A? And condition I'm going to impose on those conditional credences that it's not. So, that's if you've got a situation that PBR are thinking about where you've got a fragment of this, a subset of the state space that's represented as a Cartesian product. And if you have that independence, then this condition that I'm calling the preparation and informative condition satisfied. So it's entailed by the PUC is entailed by the PIP. But it is strictly weaker. For one reason is I didn't say anything about the structure of the state space. I didn't say that. I didn't say that this ontic state consists of an ordered pair of something relevant to one system and something relevant to the other. But I didn't presuppose anything about the structure of the state space. And even if you do assume this Cartesian product assumption, it's fairly easy to show that the PUC is strictly weaker than the no correlations assumption.
That's one question. I'm a bit confused. So omega is supposed to give you information about which preparation was chosen.
So omega is it's the ontic state of the system.
And that gives you information about what preparation was chosen.
Yeah.
Say you always choose the same preparation. Then you know that the preparation was psi 1 and psi 2.
There's some human element here. Like what the human has a probabilistic distribution of different choices of preparation.
Yeah.
Okay, so you choose.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that there is a choice of operations, and.
And that choice we've probably nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Good. And that these are all non-zero. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I missed.
Yeah, if there's only one possible proper. If there's only one possible preparation, then this is trivially satisfied.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Okay.
Sorry, I think your mic has fallen.
Oops. Thank you. All right. Now, how do I see the status of this? I think what it's meant to do is capture part of the content of the assumption that it is actually possible to conduct local preparations that make, screen off things that happen at a distance. It's not a causal locality assumption. And I want to emphasize this. It's only meant to hold for a certain kind of operations that I'm going to count as local preparations. I am definitely not assuming that that something similar holds for any operations whatsoever, and because that would be false in quantum mechanics. And to see that, imagine you've got a pair of systems, and let psi be any entangled state. And Zurich, a number of years ago, in a paper in 2005, shows that there's always going to be local unitaries on the Hilbert spaces of the component systems, such that if you just apply UA, that changes the state. If you just apply UB, that changes the state, but applying both of them doesn't. Way to see that, do a Schmidt decomposition. A local unitary can change the relative phase of the elements. And what I do on one side, I can undo on the other. OK. So those preparations wouldn't satisfy the analog of a PUC, because if Alice and Bob choose with equal probabilities between doing nothing or doing their unitary, and then the daemon comes along and says, well, they start, and you know that they started with psi, daemon comes along and says the final state is psi, then you know there's one of two possibilities out of the four. It's either this one or this one. And then if I tell you which one was done on one of them, you know which one was done on the other. So that would be an example of something that doesn't count as a pair of local preparations in this sense. And I'm not assuming that operations like that satisfy the PUC. It's meant to be capture part of the idea that local preparations are possible. So, all right. Okay. I need to finish up, but. It's both our systems, pair of preparations on each, such that the resulting set of four alternatives is again an anti-distinguishable set, just as in the PBR theorem. That means that there's no four-way joint overlap between those four probability distributions. I claim that if I now impose a PUC, that means that the ontic state omega always permits unique determination of at least one of the subsystem preparations. And basically, the argument is that, well, suppose that if I give you the ontic state and you're undecided about what was done on A and what was done on B. That can only be because it's either in the overlap of these two or it's in the overlap of those two. There's only two ways you can be undecided about both of them. So suppose it's in the overlap of those ones. Because there's no four-way overlap, it can't also be in the overlap of the other two. It's got to be incompatible with one of the other two. Let's say it's incompatible with this one. Well, then you're undecided between you're undecided between those two, but you're certain it's not that one. And if I now tell you, hey, Bob's preparation was phi, well, you know it's not that, so that, you know, erases your indecision of, between those two alternatives. So telling you about one preference. So if there is any, if there's no four-way overlap of the preparations, if there's any overlap between these two, then the PUC is violated. So conclusion is anti-distinguishability of those four preparations plus the PUC entails that there's no overlap between those two. Those are ontologically distinct. And no overlap between those two. Yeah, the two overlaps that will leave you undecided about. Okay, that was step one. Second step is, imagine you've got a lot of these systems, some big system consisting of n of them, and you subject each one of these to one of these two preparations. And we still have pairwise anti-distinguishability of the four possible preparations. So for any pair of those systems, there's an experiment that will rule out one of the combinations, psi-psi, psi-phi, you know, one of those four combinations. From the argument in the previous slide, the ontic state of this whole big thing, sigma n, if we assume the PUC, has to uniquely determine the preparation of, for each pair has to uniquely determine the preparation of at least one member of the pair. That means that the ontic state of this whole big system has to uniquely determine the preparation of almost all of those, all but at most one exception. Because if there's two that it underdetermines the preparation of, there's some pair. So if I now randomly choose a subsystem and I'll give you the ontic state, and then someone randomly chooses a subsystem, you've got probably at least 1 over 1n that ontic state tells you what the preparation of that subsystem is. Now, I think very natural something is if I've got ontic state of this big thing, nothing prevents someone from going and preparing a bunch of other systems in that choice. So the ontic state of sigma n has to be, we ought to think, I claim, it should be compatible with it being part of a larger system of arbitrary large size. If that's true, then the ontic state of my system has to be probability that the ontic state uniquely identifies the preparation of a randomly chosen system is at least 1 minus 1 over n prime for all n prime no matter big, and the only number that's bigger than 1 minus 1 n prime for numbers no matter big is 1. So with probability 1, the ontic state of sigma n uniquely identifies the preparation of a randomly chosen subsystem. I'm going to stop there. The result is robust under approximations, but if you want details for that, I'm going to have to refer you to. Do I have it on a slide? I thought I did. Anyways, the paper that's on the archive, I think I added in on the first slide. Okay. All right.
So if anyone has, let's say, one short time recurring question, we'll take that, and then otherwise we'll move to the collecting lounge and open up the discussion more generally.
I think it's a short question, it's a rhetorical question. So basically, you have shown that you can't have both lambda, hidden variables, and epistemic quantum states. And in the introduction, you have said that you find it implausible to abandon lambda, and therefore you abandon.
Okay, when you say random hidden variables, what do you mean by hidden variables?
Well, omega.
So here's the thing, yeah. I do assume that it's okay to talk about the physical states of these systems. Yeah. I'm not assuming that the physical states are have any kind of structure, you know, except the PUC. I am assuming that there's nothing that forbids us from talking, asking. So if in fact I can reliably use a system as a medium for communication, I am assuming that I can ask, well, why? You know, what effect are you having on the state of the system that makes it possible? I am assuming that. Right, yeah. But here I want to say is, I think that I actually do have good reason to believe, and I think you do too, that what I do to my laptop today has an effect on the state of the laptop that I can find out tomorrow. I think we have good evidence of that. That's my claim. Now you can say, well, I don't have to talk about the state of the laptop. And that's true, you don't. But I think if you don't, then you're just not going to talk about certain things that you actually do have good evidence for.
So since we're over time, let's stop here, and we can always continue the discussion.